The first votes in the presidential election will be cast next week in Iowa. But what's on the minds of Arizona voters?
I think security is the one that floats to the top. The economy is always that way. There's always concern about the economy remaining stable ever since the 2008 economic crisis.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, South Phoenix may get its light rail line sooner than expected, hitting the streets to find out what homelessness looks like here.
Canadian firms are outsourcing to Arizona.
And new standards for the equipment young athletes wear.
If we can put a protector on you and decrease your risk of an event that, if it happens, almost certainly results in death, that's a huge leap forward.
Plus, a master of Oaxacan wood carving, and we hit the pickleball court.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody along with Steve Goldstein. Quick check of Valley traffic. One accident to tell you about. It's on the 202 eastbound Red Mountain Freeway at 32nd Street. The shoulder is blocked there. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon with a high of 74, a few degrees warmer than average. Partly cloudy tonight, overnight lows near 50. Partly sunny tomorrow with a high of 76. It's 65 degrees right now at KJZZ. Walgreens has told Theranos, a blood testing startup with a presence in Arizona, that it will immediately stop using the company's lab in California. From the KJZZ Business Desk, Christina Estes reports on what led to the move and what it means for Arizona customers.
Walgreens' decision to stop using the California lab came after the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services warned about deficiencies at the lab. There have been no warnings about the lab in Scottsdale, and Walgreens said Theranos tests collected at 40 Arizona stores must be sent only to the Scottsdale lab or an accredited third-party lab. In a statement, Theranos said the federal findings do not reflect the current state of the California lab, and a full plan of correction will be submitted within days. Last year, Arizona Governor Doug Ducey signed a bill that allows consumers to get blood tests without a doctor's order. Theranos is partnering with Walgreens to provide a variety of tests that people pay for out of pocket. According to the company's website, tests range from $2 to more than $100. Christine Astis, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
This week, we've been having a national conversation on NPR about politics and the issues causing voters the most anxiety this election cycle. Earlier in the week, we heard from Mara Liasson about concerns regarding stagnant wages, terrorism, and congressional dysfunction. But to find out what major concerns are on the minds of Arizona voters, I'm joined by David Doherty of the Morrison Institute for Public Policy. So, David, what are the major concerns?
I think there's no question that the security issue, for lack of a better term, seems to be rising more and more. The terrorism incidents that have been plaguing the country and a lot of the shootings, I think, have raised the voters' sensitivity to those issues. We have done some work where we're looking at what voters consider to be the most important issues facing Arizona. We did a poll among registered voters to see what they had to say. Education continuously rises to the top.
One issue that people in Arizona think about a lot, but at the national level, wasn't getting quite as much attention. And then people are saying, well, now that Donald Trump has talked about it, and that's illegal immigration. How big is that to people in Arizona?
It's, you know, we tested about 10 or 12 issues, and immigration, you're absolutely right, came in third. I think with the discussions, particularly among the Republican candidates for the nomination, have brought that more and more to the forefront.
And can you break it down for us a little bit based on party designation or non-party designation, based on the average, what Republicans, Democrats, and those who are independents in Arizona think?
Education is highest among Democrats as the number one issue in their mind. Among Republicans, the biggest issue is immigration and how tax dollars are spent are essentially numbers two and three. Among independents, education rises to the top, and then immigration and how money is spent are second and third. So the big difference, I think, is that the education issue is incredibly important to those to registered Democrats. Taxes and how money is spent is highly important to Republicans.
How do we know, or how can we gauge whether voters actually back this sort of thing up when they actually go to the poll?
That's a fair question. It's difficult to know if they are, they're voting essentially their conscience or voting what they say they believe. And as you know, a lot of voters are simply vote straight tickets and will vote on propositions the way that the political party they support recommends that they vote. That's not uncommon. The thing in Arizona that's most interesting, I think, is that the number of independent voters is growing. I think it just went from 37% to 38% of registered voters are now independents. And those folks are a bit tougher to know exactly what they're going to do. It is more likely they will vote their conscience because they don't have a party to vote a straight party ticket. The electorate is changing because of what we see as a polarization of the parties, that to vote a straight ticket means you're going to vote for a lot of issues in a particular fashion, whereas a lot of voters believe some of the things that the Democrats purport and believe a lot of the things that the Republicans purport, then they don't really have candidates to vote for who represent all their positions.
The word anxiety comes up at different periods of time, certainly probably more so since the Great Recession. Are there any issues that strike you? You mentioned security. Anything else that sort of falls into that anxious category?
I think security is the one that floats to the top. The economy is always that way. There's always concern about the economy remaining stable. Ever since the 2008 economic crisis, it's fairly fresh in everyone's mind, and so there was always concern that there are enough jobs and that everyone is going to be economically stable.
David Dougherty is Associate Director of the Morrison Institute at ASU.
Arizona has long been a destination for Canadians, often during the winter. But more and more Canadian companies are opening U.S. operations here. St. Clair Technologies is one of them. The Ontario-based firm manufactures wire harnesses and has been in operation for 65 years. For the past three, the company's executive staff has been based in Chandler. Charlie Hess is the firm's president. And Charlie, why move to Arizona?
Well, I think Chandler is a really happening area, and my company has been a long-term provider of electrical systems to the automotive industry, but we located here primarily because a lot of us from Canada wanted to live in this area, as well as the fact that we see a great opportunity to service the aviation and aerospace groups housed here and to our south in Tucson and surrounding areas.
Was it really just a matter of quality of life and the weather here? And were there other places that you were considering going in the States besides Arizona?
Well, I tell you, we picked this location because we wanted the transportation hub out of Sky Harbor. And I have a sales force that is often on the road, so am I. And when I chose to relocate here with my family, we wanted to be within approximately a 1/2 hour drive to the airport because we are servicing Mexico from that location, as well as direct flights back to Toronto, Vancouver, all the major Canadian cities, and of course throughout the USA where our customers are located.
But there are other American cities, even other southern or southwestern cities that have major metropolitan airports that could probably get you to Mexico and back up to Canada fairly easily. Was there something else about Arizona or even the Valley specifically that led you to say, yes, this is where we want to be?
Well, it's an innovative area, that's for sure. And although I can't speak with a great deal of authority on all of the amenities in the greater Phoenix region, this is the closest location to where our current manufacturing site is in the city of Guaymas, Sonora, Mexico. So Texas and California, or even Florida, I mean, that none of those areas, New Mexico, really made a lot of sense for us. It was really just a question of distance and direction to the plant, but our plant existed long before we chose to come here. I liked it because we actually got into this office at a time when it was very attractive from a commercial real estate standpoint. And again, it's the proximity to a very large group of customers that we want to work with. So we are seeking their business in the aviation marketplace.
Charlie Hess is president and part owner of St. Clair Technologies, an Ontario-based firm with an office in Chandler. Charlie, thank you.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
A report done by the Maricopa Association of Governments found more Canadian businesses in Arizona than those from any other foreign country. For more on this, I'm joined by Glenn Williamson. He's CEO of the Canada-Arizona Business Council. And Glenn, how common is it for Canadian firms to outsource in Arizona?
So Canada has had a long-time love affair with the state of Arizona, but it took the recession to really change the game plan. It was always tracking and going upwards. But when the recession hit, many of those tourists, which are now close to 1 million a year, transferred into home ownership. And many of those were decision makers and CEOs, and we're starting to watch many of them say, I'm interested in having my U.S. operations close to me. So Arizona, because it's a great tax state, obviously when you look out the window of your studio, you can see beautiful blue sunshine. This captures a lot of Canadians when it's -9 and snowing.
So are you finding that these are new American operations? Are they operations that had been elsewhere in the states that are moving now to Arizona?
It's a combination of both. The very beginning was new operations. And the second set of operations was when we started to see companies that were questioning why they were living in snow and had U.S. operations in snow. So as fundamental and as silly as it sounds, without all the economic development perks that go along with trying to move companies here, Canadians were not really interested in that. They were truly interested in the quality of life.
What kinds of companies are we talking about here?
Started off with aerospace. It's got a lot of mining history, a lot of agricultural history. Now we're seeing life science, we're seeing advanced technologies, we're seeing enormous amounts of electronics type companies coming in. We're seeing utilities like the company that I'm chairman of, EPCOR USA. We're a very, very big company out of Canada, and we've spent close to $1 billion down here in the last 3 years.
What kinds of operations are these companies opening up here? I mean, are these offices? Are they factories? Is it a little bit of both? Is it something else?
It's a combination of everything. We're watching manufacturing companies that want to be closer to California, closer to Texas, and proximity to Mexico. We're seeing food services companies like Leclerc out of Quebec come down here to service very large clients. And instead of setting up in California for a whole host of reasons, mostly regulatory and taxes, they've opted to come into this neck of the woods. So California for Canadian companies has become expensive and cumbersome. And we're getting a little bit of that rebound coming into this neck of the woods.
Is there a sense of what kind of impact this move has had on Canada's economy and Arizona's economy?
Very little on Canada's economy. Remember that Canada exports 80% of everything it makes to the United States. It's the largest supplier of every form of energy to the U.S. So the relationship is so symbiotic. What we're seeing is a shift of industries that were previously going to other states. And now all of a sudden they're falling into Arizona. And that's new. So instead of New York getting something or New Jersey getting a manufacturing plant, they're coming here.
But to be clear, we're not talking about Canadian firms just totally up and moving to Arizona.
No.
These are sort of outposts of those
Correct.
Firms that will maintain their presence in Canada.
Correct. Every Canadian company worth its salt that sells or manufactures anything has a U.S. operation. It's just the way it is. So now what we're seeing is the new companies that are coming online are going, maybe we want to go to Arizona first. The older companies that have predisposition of locations in other parts of the U.S. are now saying, maybe I want to shift my groups around a little bit and have more people in the Arizona market. And that's something that's making this big move.
Do you foresee this continuing? I mean, do you think Arizona will continue to be as popular with Canadian firms as it is now?
I think this is the tip of the iceberg. I think we are going to see, if we have 350 companies here, I'll be shocked within 5 years if that's not close to 500 or 700 companies.
Glenn Williamson is the CEO of the Canada-Arizona Business Council. Glenn, thank you.
You're very, very welcome, Mark.
Every year on one day in January, the Maricopa Association of Governments conducts the Point in Time Homeless Count. It captures what homelessness looks like here and across the country on one night.
The count is critical in securing millions of dollars in federal funding from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development every year to pay for shelters and transitional housing programs. The show's Lauren Gilger joined some of the volunteers who hit the streets this week.
The sun won't be out for hours, but these volunteers are hitting the streets on a mission.
Cardboard boxes, shopping carts, backpacks, duffel bags, things like that.
Usually you're going to look for little camps as well.
John Willard, Anne Marie Johnston, and Julie Wansiewicz Moore are walking quickly, shining flashlights through the early morning darkness, looking behind dumpsters and around corners in the industrial neighborhoods near the airport in Phoenix.
Come back and hit that side of the bridge and that whole triangle.
They are looking for homeless people before the sun rises and before police and the light of day get them on the move.
My name is Anne Marie. I'm with Community Bridges.
They've been assigned a grid to cover, like more than 300 other volunteers fanned out around the county this morning. Their goal? To count and survey the homeless population in Maricopa County.
Things change in the homeless population, just like they change with any population. So understanding the demographics, understanding the needs helps us better serve them. And we can't do that behind a desk, you know what I mean?
This team of three is invested in the homeless more than most. They work for one of the state's largest behavioral health providers, Community Bridges, and they understand there's always a story behind someone sleeping on the streets.
Everybody just sees somebody drunk or high. They don't see what caused that, the trauma or the mental illness.
As they approach an elderly man at a bus stop, Anne Marie asks the questions and Julie logs his answers on a clipboard.
Is this your first time homeless?
No.
No. Do you have any psychiatric or emotional conditions, depression, schizophrenia?
Bipolar.
Each homeless person they encounter, they ask to answer a series of questions like this. They ask for age, race, gender, veteran status, if they drink alcohol or use illegal drugs, if they've been physically or sexually abused. Some people are willing to give their names. Others aren't willing to answer any questions at all.
Have you ever had a traumatic brain injury?
Yes, I have.
You have?
Last year, the Maricopa Association of Governments point-in-time homeless count tallied more than 5,600 homeless people on the streets and in shelters across the county. The number of homeless people has generally been going down across the country in recent years, and last year's total in Maricopa County was down almost 300 from the year before. But that does not mean every homeless person they meet this morning is looking for help.
Can you offer him any services?
If he was willing to take them, but he didn't want to take them.
There's a large dirt lot on the freeway near 48th Street that's strewn with trash. Walking through it just as the sun comes up behind us, we see a man stand up and stretch.
Hey, sir. Over here.
So where did you sleep at last night? Right up there on the hill? Okay.
On the sidewalk next to the freeway off-ramp, a woman stands next to her husband, who's sitting in a wheelchair holding up a sign.
And then I'm just going to ask you if any of these situations pertain to you. We don't judge. We just use this for collective information. Do you drink alcohol?
Yes.
Do you use any illegal drugs or prescription drugs?
Okay.
They answer yes. That prevents them from living in stable housing.
Is there any kind of services we can help you with today? No, you guys are good?
Yeah.
You don't want to come in for treatment?
No.
Okay.
Under the freeway, Anne Marie looks behind brush and in what looks like an abandoned encampment.
Community Bridges here to help.
She works as a peer support and outreach supervisor for Community Bridges. She's a peer to those in crisis because she's been there before.
You know, I went 33 years of my life working at a bank, worked for Ford Motor Credit Company. You know, I had a good job, I had a family, I had kids.
But she became addicted to methamphetamines and spent the next 10 years of her life in and out of jail and prison.
And so there's so many different areas of my life that I can touch on with another client or a patient of ours. And I think that that's kind of, it's been crucial and it's very helpful because when a patient comes through the door, we don't know what's going on with them.
Most of the people we encountered on the streets today said they didn't want any services, they didn't need any help. But Anne Marie has been there before, and that's why she says she keeps trying.
Nobody could have helped me until I was ready, so I have to look at it through my own experiences. What did I go through? How many times did somebody try to force me to get help and get treatment? But you just keep trying because one day, they're going to get it. And when they do, I want to be a part of it.
In Phoenix, Lauren Gilger, KJZZ News.
The number of homeless people counted this year won't be totaled for several months, but officials tell us they're hoping the numbers continue to fall this year.
Coming up, what's the potential impact of sexual harassment situations in university science departments?
Those sorts of things can go on for a long time without the university becoming aware of it, very sadly.
We'll discuss that troubling trend later. It's the show. Good afternoon with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. In Valley traffic on this Friday afternoon, we find collisions on the 202 westbound. That's the Red Mountain Freeway at 32nd Street. Also, a couple of collisions on the 60 eastbound. One at Alma School blocking the right lane, the other at the 101 blocking the shoulder. Valley weather for tonight, we expect partly cloudy skies with overnight lows in the mid to upper 40s. Should be partly to mostly sunny tomorrow with a high in the mid 70s. Currently, relative humidity is at 21%. It's partly cloudy and 67 degrees at KJZZ at 224.
KJZZ is supported by Scottsdale Center for the Performing Arts. Grammy Award-winning pianist and Pops conductor Peter Nero shares classics of the Great American Songbook February 12th. Tickets at scottsdaleperformingarts.org.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Huckenberry.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. President Obama announced a new proposal today aimed at closing the gender wage gap. This issue had been a presidential priority since President Obama took office in 2009 when he signed his first piece of legislation, the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act.
The goal is to help businesses that are trying to do the right thing, like the ones here today, to get a clear picture of how they can ensure their employees are being treated equally. A better picture of the data will also help us do a better job enforcing existing equal pay laws.
President of the White House today, the executive order requires companies with 100 employees or more to report salary information by gender, race, and ethnicity to the federal government. 63 million Americans will be covered by this new rule. The president's executive order also comes as the Pentagon is shaking up its family leave policy. Now all female troops will get 12 weeks of maternity leave, a move that affects up to 200,000 women. Joining us, Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. What impact on the overall labor force are these rules likely to have, Todd?
Well, you're talking about 63 million workers, or maybe a little bit more, up to 65 million workers who would be covered under the new order. What it does really so far, though, is not so much for equal pay itself. It really arms the government, John, with more data to make the case. The federal government already requires federal contractors, defense contractors, you know, whoever, somebody gets a contract with the federal government, they have to report pay data back to the government by age, sex, and race, how much people get paid in those different groups. For the comparison, private companies, if they don't have federal contracts, don't really have to do that right now. And that's what the new rule does. It says to them, they already report our workers are 74%, you know, over the age of 30, whatever, you know, age, sex, and race. Now they have to add pay to the mix. So the Labor Department has the data. They say this will improve transparency. It'll sort of put it all out there for the public to see and ultimately improve the administration's argument about the need for fair pay.
What are the thresholds here under which people can actually sue? Is it the egregiousness of the disparity? Is there some intent that has to be proven here? What range of evidence will allow employers to try to get redress, or employees to try to get redress?
That's a separate issue under the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act that you mentioned, which is separate from what's going on today. That was a right of action that was restored for women to sue if they can show pay discrimination for similar jobs or they can show intent to deprive them of pay.
This data help them make those cases?
Well, it would certainly have a paper trail for a company if they reported back to the government. I'm not a lawyer, but I have to think that that would be discoverable, of course.
And what about the maternity leave? This works very positively for some members of the military, but for others, maybe not so much.
Yeah, separate issue over at the Pentagon. And John, this is the culmination of a problem that planners at the Pentagon have been seeing for years. The fact that a Pentagon salary for somebody who wants to be in the military for a career, that an average family of four who's going to have a military career just can't make it on what soldiers get paid. The result of that, millennials, young people, aren't going to choose military careers, even if they come in the service for 3 or 5 years for a normal enlistment. So this is part of a whole series of new policies that Ash Carter, the Secretary of Defense, has been trying to implement over at the Pentagon. It now says that women across the services get 3 months of paid maternity leave, regardless of the service. Now, if you're in the Army or the Coast Guard or the Air Force, this is a big increase. It's actually an increase in the policies they had before. And of course, the Army is the biggest service. In the Navy and Marines, they had 18 weeks before, so they're getting knocked down to 3 months. So it's a little bit of a deficit in those services, but the Secretary of Defense has said he thinks it's important for all of the services to have a common standard. At the same time, men across the services now get 14 days paid paternity leave instead of 10. And it's all an effort at that much broader problem of retention and attraction for young people to choose a career in the military. They've also made changes a couple of months back to the pension program, John, where people can start accruing matching pension funds in the military salary. Before, they had to wait 20 years for the careerists.
Is this a bipartisan issue? Is this one of these secret things where there's a lot of agreement or not so much?
I think on the maternity leave issue, there's probably plenty of agreement. There wasn't a whole lot of agreement on the other issues, you remember, which is opening combat roles to women. That's still controversial.
Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much, Todd.
You got it, John.
Three examples of sexual harassment by prominent science professors at universities have come to light recently. One of them is former University of Arizona astronomy professor Timothy Slater, who's currently at the University of Wyoming. That situation was made public by U.S. Representative Jackie Speier. John Hawks, professor at the University of Wisconsin, wrote a column about sexual harassment at university science departments for the online publication Medium. Hawks wondered whether the institutions are trying to avoid punishing professors who bring in significant grant money, and he joins me now. John, why are these circumstances seemingly being swept under the rug?
What we see around the country is when revelations come out of sexual harassment cases, it seems to be the case that we never know about it, that universities keep these proceedings very private. It seems to be something that, you know, that they don't want to get out. And you hear them talk to victims of harassment during these proceedings and say, don't reveal what's happened to you, please don't discuss your case. You know, so this seems to be the default, that they're just not, you know, universities are not being forthcoming about the results of these things.
It almost feels like the universities are trying to have it both ways. Is that troubling?
As a professor at a research university, my job is to do research and bring that research into my classroom and enable my graduate students to become participants, you know, teach them how to do research by doing it with them. And at the graduate student level and for postdoctoral scientists, that's a relationship that is, you know, is really deep. You know, I have very close relationships, working relationships with my graduate students. I spend a lot of time working with them. And you could imagine a situation where a professor who's supervising students like this, you know, the oversight potential, you have to be really, really responsible with everything that you do with your students. For somebody that is of a personality that's likely to harass their female subordinates or is likely to be abusive in terms of, you know, demanding an unreasonable amount of work and throwing tantrums if the students aren't working, you know, those sorts of things can go on for a long time without the university becoming aware of it, very sadly.
And when we think about professors who are getting some of these major grants, one would think that other universities, even with certain accusations, might be lined up to grab them. Is that pretty likely as well?
You know, when you look at somebody's CV, at the medium, you know, at the mid-career level, once somebody has tenure and they're thinking of moving, you look at their CV and you say, okay, what have they published? What grants have they gotten? And somebody that has a long grant record on their CV, a university is going to look at that who might be interested in this person and say, wow, here's somebody who's ready to fund their own work. And from an administrator's point of view, you look at that and say, well, they're going to bring money into the university. You know, it's not a case where I'm spending money to get them. They're going to bring money in. It's you know, it's an investment to bring in additional federal dollars when you are looking at these scientists that are heavy grant getters.
There's been more of an effort to get young females involved in the sciences, and though I don't want to assume that all harassment is male to female, is this something that could hurt getting more females involved in the sciences?
it definitely perpetuates a culture that females are finding to be a challenge at every level. And it's a great point that this isn't just women. In anthropology, you know, I'm an anthropologist. We do a lot of field research. We go out into field situations. We bring students with us to help dig, you know, or to help study people in the field. And a study in 2014 was published that upwards of 60% of women in field situations have undergone some form of sexual harassment. And upwards of 25% of men in those situations have undergone some sort of sexual harassment situation. To me, as a scientist, it just is so frustrating to know how many of my young colleagues out there have undergone these terrible situations, and with so little having been done by the universities that are supposed to be protecting them.
University of Wisconsin professor John Hawks, who recently wrote an article for Medium about sexual harassment in university science departments.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. The show is a KJZZ original production, mixing news and features from the Valley, the region, and national and international news to provide a stream of engaging radio. Not much engaging about the 60 right now. The eastbound side, the right lane, is blocked at Alma School. Also a collision on the 60 eastbound at Loop 101, that blocking the shoulder. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon today with a high of 74 degrees. 72 was average for today. 69 is average. Partly cloudy tonight, overnight lows near 50. Partly sunny tomorrow with a high of 76. And still to come, South Phoenix may be getting its light rail line more than a decade sooner than originally thought. That means planning for the disruption to area businesses.
It's not just, you know, throwing out a marketing campaign. It's creating real funds that can be there to help them sustain pre, during, and post-construction.
That's ahead. It's the show. Sunny skies, 67 degrees at 2:35.
KJZZ is supported by AJ's Fine Foods, offering a gourmet game plan with gridiron subs, party platters, USDA prime steaks, fresh-made guacamole, and craft beers. 10 Valley locations can be found at ajsfinefoods.com.
From NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. In Brazil, the mosquito-borne Zika virus and its effects are causing concern over the summer's Olympics in Rio de Janeiro. NPR's Lourdes Garcia Navarro reports from Rio that the International Olympic Committee is issuing an advisory to those competing in the Games.
The IOC says it will send advice on how to deal with the Zika virus to all the national committees this week. There is concern that the virus, which is spreading rapidly in the region and is possibly linked to brain damage in infants, could affect both athletes and visitors. Rio de Janeiro's mayor says there's no cause for concern. The games will be held in the cooler and drier winter months when the mosquito population is naturally lower. The government is also doing daily inspections of Olympic facilities here, they say. This is only the latest bad news for the games, which have already seen huge budget cuts because of the economic crisis in Brazil. Ticket sales for events have so far been slow, and some people are canceling trips to Brazil in light of warnings over the Zika virus. Lourdes Garcia Navarro, NPR News, Rio de Janeiro.
The latest snapshot of the U.S. economy could renew doubts about whether the 6.5-year-old economic expansion will last. The government says the economy's growth slowed sharply in the final 3 months of 2015 to a 0.7% annual rate. But Moody's Analytics chief economist Mark Zandi says a poor fourth quarter isn't something that affects the average consumer.
So far, at least, people are shrugging off the weakening in the stock market. It's not showing up in readings on consumer sentiment and confidence. So that's a very positive sign.
On Wall Street, stocks surged more than 2% today after the Bank of Japan unexpectedly cut interest rates, and Microsoft led a strong rally in technology stocks. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up 396 points. This is NPR West.
And good afternoon in KJZZ News at 2:37. Starting Monday, officials at Prescott National Forest temporarily will restrict access to both Granite Mountain and Thumb Butte so peregrine falcons can nest. Noah Fletcher is a wildlife biologist with the forest. She says peregrines have successfully nested at Granite Mountain for the past 20 years and 18 at Thumb Butte. Still,
the challenge is when people don't understand why the closure is in place and they don't
follow the instructions of the fencing and the signing. They don't understand that they can cause that pair to abandon their nesting attempt and be unsuccessful.
Although peregrine are no longer on the endangered species list, they are still protected under other laws. The restrictions will remain in place until July 15th.
The Phoenix City Council this week voted to recommend speeding up a couple of light rail lines, including the one to South Phoenix. Originally, the plan was to open the line going down Central Avenue to Baseline in 2034. Now it could open in 2023, 11 years earlier. The proposed changes are now sent to the Valley Metro Board of Directors and Maricopa Association of Governments. Final adoption could come this summer. For more on how this would impact South Phoenix, I'm joined by Victor Vidalis. He owns REMAX New Heights Realty in the neighborhood and is a supporter of the extension into South Phoenix. Victor, what do you think when you heard about the plans being sped up?
Well, we got really excited. And when we saw that being an agenda item, actually myself and a number of our community leaders actually showed up to speak on to advocate for it, because we really believed that it was the right thing to do. Our community fought really hard to try to get the vote out for Proposition 104 to get the funds available so that they could expedite this.
What will it mean for your neighborhood to have this light rail in more than a decade earlier potentially than you thought it would be?
Well, it means a lot of things. And I think primarily, you know, it's connecting us to the rest of Phoenix, you know. And you've got to look at both the short-term and long-term impact that this will have. And initially, you know, it's going to be rough. We're going to have to really go through some challenges with construction. It's not going to be easy. So I think for our community, we're really aware of that. We see the future, and we see the potential that it can bring for job creation, for the connection to major universities throughout the city, access to healthcare. And jobs, you know, bringing access to jobs. So, you know, we got to kind of temper the great things that are to come, because we're really excited about that. But we know that there, now that this acceleration has happened, the community and the neighborhood really has to be involved in how all this gets laid out, and be involved as much as we can so that we can mitigate some of the challenges that will occur with construction and the like.
When you talk about some of those challenges, will it be harder to do and to try to mitigate some of them, knowing that you have less time to plan for them and try to deal with them?
Yeah, I think it is going to be tough. But the one thing that I think this has done, or what I've seen in my involvement with light rail over the past 5 years, and even before that with Rio Salado Beyond the Banks, is that this has unified the community and the city and Valley Metro and all the folks that are working on this. So I really believe that the communication's there to really create something that's beneficial for all parties.
When you talk about some of the construction and the effect on businesses that will be along where the light rail will be and where the construction's going to be, do you anticipate that some of those are just going to go out of business? I mean, it's happened in other parts of town where some businesses along the line have gone out of business. Do you expect that to happen here? And do you expect new companies to open up at some point along sort of in those places?
I don't expect that to happen, but when you look at the history of light rail, it has happened. But what I saw in the city council and what I've seen throughout this entire process is really they understand that this part of the valley is different than other parts of the valley. And there are over 250 businesses that are in this corridor that have 10 employees or less. We have a lot of diversity in the type of businesses that are being ran there. If we can put together a program, that's part of the approval that happened on Tuesday, was there was $1.5 million dollar approval for the New Starts program, so they can finish that off, which includes them taking a look at a business assistance program. And the business assistance program is good, but I think it's a little more comprehensive for South Phoenix, because a lot of the businesses that are there are actually schools. So when I look at businesses, we need to look at the schools, the institutions that are there, the churches that are there. So we just have to work together, and the community has to be involved and work with Valley Metro as they start to figure out what does this business assistance program look like. It could be more of a community assistance program. There's other models that have already are out there in the country that we can look to say, hey, these are the type of things that we want to see for South Phoenix. It's not just, you know, throwing out a marketing campaign. It's creating real funds that can be there to help them sustain pre, during, and post-construction.
Victor Vidalis owns RE/MAX New Heights Realty in South Phoenix. Victor, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
More than a decade ago, community leaders across Arizona determined the biosciences and related industries offered a great opportunity for economic competitiveness with the potential to make a big impact in healthcare. Now, Arizona's Bioscience Roadmap Steering Committee has announced new leadership in the continuing effort to advance biosciences in the state. Ron Schupman, who leads the Southern Arizona Leadership Council, is the steering committee's new chair. And Ron, how are the biosciences doing in Arizona right now?
One of the quotes from Michael Crow came at the 10-year anniversary of the Bioscience Roadmap when he said, when we started this 10 years ago, Arizona wasn't even in view of the stadium, and we have done a terrific job to get to the edge of the playing field. And so in this next 10 years, the goal is to get off the bench and get in the game in a very meaningful way. And interpreted in my words, we really started from a very low starting point in terms of national and international recognition. And today, Arizona is on people's radar.
When it comes to competition like this, whether it's with Arizona and San Diego and Arizona and Boston, Arizona, whatever market it may be, are there certain things that that Arizona is able to do that has nothing to do with its competition that the state could be doing better or some missed opportunities?
Obviously, we have some advantages here, and I'll talk first about that. I think one of the big advantages we enjoy was identified by Battelle, who did some of the initial work for the roadmap, and they coined the phrase that we have a collaborative gene. The people of Arizona, whether they're from Tucson, Flagstaff, or Phoenix, that are in this industry are willing to work together for the good of the state because they realize that working together, we're stronger. Our voice can be stronger, whether it's to support legislation we need or whether it's to address an issue like the shortage of risk capital or just creating that environment that fosters innovation and an innovation-based economy that creates the high-paying, high-wage jobs that we really all want to see for our state. Are there things we can do better? You bet. We are working with the legislature to try to make sure that we have the tools for the Arizona Commerce Authority and therefore our businesses to help them grow. And one significant bill that's pending is an angel investment tax credit bill that will continue to allow startup companies the opportunity to take root and grow and expand in our state. We've got to ensure that there's some level of funding in those kinds of buckets so that we can play in the game on the national stage.
Now, Ron, you're someone who is based in Southern Arizona, and here in Phoenix, we talk a lot about the Biosciences Corridor in downtown Phoenix, but based on the fact this is the Arizona Bioscience Roadmap and not the Maricopa County Bioscience Roadmap, what are we missing if we focus too much on Maricopa County?
The beauty of the bioscience opportunity for Arizona is that there is great work going on not only in Maricopa County, but in Flagstaff and in Tucson. In fact, Tucson is a real bioscience hub with well over 100 bioscience companies down here. All three regions are fueled by the universities that sit squarely in the middle of each region of the state. And that's a key element of growing life science companies is the discovery that takes place at our universities.
Ron Schupman is the new chair of Arizona's Bioscience Roadmap Steering Committee. He was previously the vice chair. Ron, thanks very much for the time.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
New standards for the chest protectors young athletes wear will take effect next year after the National Operating Committee on Standards for Athletic Equipment, or NOCSE's board, approved the move today in Phoenix. The goal is to prevent commotio cordis, which is the number two cause of sudden cardiac arrest in the U.S. and usually only affects people younger than 20. For more on this, I'm joined by Dr. Jeff Mianis. He's a physician in Chicago and a board member of NOCSE.
What it is if you get struck in the chest, usually, especially if it's directly over the heart, especially over the left ventricle, at the basically right moment or wrong moment in the cardiac cycle, which is only this brief, like 20 millisecond window, it will induce an arrhythmia called ventricular fibrillation, which is unfortunately almost always fatal in these cases. The problem has been the methodology to go about this, to actually find a good animal model, a good surrogate, a good way of testing this and coming up with minimal passing criteria has been what we have been working on. And so now we have gotten to a point where we feel extremely comfortable with great data that back up this idea of a pass-fail system that we can now employ for these chest protectors.
So what are these protectors going to look like, and how will they be different than what some of these athletes were wearing before?
Well, what we're really doing, you know, in the end, what we have developed now are the passing criteria for the chest protector. So for a chest protector to work to reduce the risk of an athlete suffering commotio cordis, we had to come up with criteria that would say this protector would work, this protector will not work. Now, you know, truthfully, it's the next step. The last step is really for the manufacturers to come out and say, okay, we're going to take these materials and we're going to meet this standard and we're going to develop a protector that's easy to wear, doesn't overheat the athlete, doesn't move when they raise their arms, you know, stays in place. So that's kind of the final steps. I mean, the risk before probably of suffering this event was 40 to 50% with the old protectors. And if you meet this criteria, it will drop the risk to maybe 3 to 5%. So this is a huge reduction in actually a very catastrophic injury.
I'm surprised that the odds of this happening to you are so high, even 40 to 50%, given, as you said, that it's a tiny window of time and you basically have to be hit in exactly the right place.
It is. It's interesting, but it can, you know, you think about all the times that a projectile can hit you there. And so, again, it is a fairly rare condition. I mean, if you're thinking about, in general, the millions of children that play baseball and lacrosse and hockey, I mean, they have, you know, 20 cases a year. We're not talking about a very large number. But again, if we can put a protector on you and decrease your risk of an event that, if it happens, almost certainly results in death, we can reduce that. With more kids playing more sports these days, that's a huge leap forward.
How long realistically do you think it will be before these chest protectors under these new standards will be available for parents to buy for their kids?
I think the issue moving forward, and I think, you know, over the next year or two, you'll see this, are that a couple of things that I mentioned earlier, which is just that the manufacturers will need to come up with ones that meet the criteria that stay in place, are comfortable to wear. So it does need to meet a couple criteria, you know, but I would say within the next year or so, we should be able to see these out there because the materials are readily available. You know, this investigative model, the fact that we took this, we developed a hypothesis as to what causes the problem, you know, developed an animal model and a surrogate, and then created a means of decreasing that risk. This same methodology, if we can use it, we can apply it to concussions, hopefully. And so, you know, really it's the same thing. I mean, this commotio cordis is a shaking of the heart in this susceptible period. Concussion, the shaking of the brain. We need to start employing this same methodology to try to tackle the concussion problem. And we just proved with commotio cordis that we can do it.
Dr. Jeff Mianis is a physician in Chicago and a board member of the National Operating Committee on Standards for Athletic Equipment, which is meeting today in Phoenix.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark. I'm Steve. We'll stay partly cloudy through the rest of this afternoon and into tonight when overnight lows should be in the mid to upper 40s. We'll start the weekend tomorrow with partly to mostly sunny skies and a high of 76. It's currently partly cloudy and 67 degrees at KJZZ. Quick check of valley traffic, accidents on the 51 southbound at Thomas and the 101 southbound in the East Valley. A collision blocks the shoulder at McDowell. It's 252.
KJZZ is supported by Mesa Arts Center, announcing Antonio Rocha, international storyteller and mime performing characters, sound effects, and physical comedy, Friday, February 12th. Tickets and information at mesaartscenter.com.
The Western National Parks Association is hosting a trunk show this weekend in Tucson featuring wood carvings from Oaxaca, Mexico. And two of the most well-known artisans, Jacobo and his wife Maria Angeles, will be demonstrating their craft. Jim Cook is the executive director of the Western National Parks Association, which works with more than 60 parks in 12 Western states. Jim, so do you find the people who come to these events are already fans of the art form, or are they not really that familiar with it?
I'd say it's a bit of both, quite frankly. Number one, Jacobo has become a rock star, if you will, of this particular art form. He's taken it to a different level in terms of the artistry involved and the complexity of the animal figures that he creates. So we have some diehard fans that show up every year. But because we do have a membership and a number of people who come to our facilities regularly, people learn about this through our programming. So it's a bit of both, where people know about it and they want to come see it firsthand, or perhaps they're collectors already, and in other cases people are being exposed to it for the first time.
Is this an art form that is in danger of becoming extinct?
Well, I would say that the art form has probably become more popular in to some degree, certainly in certain sections of the country and in Mexico. So it was probably back in the 80s where it became a bit more well-known and the art form advanced. One of the things, however, in response to your question, is the actual wood that they use. The copal wood is in danger right now of having been over-harvested to produce these wonderful figures. So thanks to Jacobo and his wife, Maria, they have been focused on a conservation effort to preserve the wood, and they have been working on replanting and really have a very strong conservation effort. So from a resource perspective, there is some risk there, but from a popularity perspective, I think it continues to grow.
Is this the kind of art form in which the techniques that the artists use are still very similar to what has been used traditionally, or have there been advances either technological or otherwise?
I don't pretend to be a scholar on this particular subject. However, the art form has absolutely evolved from what I would describe as maybe more crude animal figures to what we see today, which is this ongoing expansion of this idea of making them fantastical. So it is really continues to evolve, and the art form has gotten particularly keen as developed by Jacobo. He's set a new standard for the fine craftsmanship that he does. So his figures are all from a single carving, a single piece of wood, as opposed to many of the other artisans still assemble different pieces of wood to create the creature in total. As in anything, in any sort of art form, this is a world of interpretation, right? So each artisan or artist brings their own approach and develops their own style.
Jim Cook is the executive director of the Western National Parks Association. Jim, thank you.
Thank you. I appreciated the time today.
Okay, Mark, important question for
you. Yes, I'm ready.
What do you get when you mix tennis, badminton, and ping pong together?
A lot of people making a racket?
I think that's probably partly right. But no, in this case, we're talking about a sport called pickleball. It's on the upswing in Arizona and across the U.S., and we'll serve it to the show's Annika Klein for more.
I got it. The sport is definitely a hit here at Venture Out RV Resort in Mesa. Just ask Ralph Sadzewski.
I'm president of the pickleball club here. We're 500 members strong.
And because this is an adult community, all those members are 55 or older. That's the key demographic for the fast-growing sport. Zagzebski says that's because pickleball takes the rules of tennis and puts them in a smaller court with smaller paddles and a slower ball.
You don't have as much running in this game. A lot of the game is placement. So knowing where the ball's going to be, you can be there a little bit quicker.
Nice play, very nice.
And like you can get beat by some 80-year-old women and it's quite humbling.
Lorene Eilert sits on the sidelines of a game, sparkly gold visor shading her eyes from the sun.
Nice shot. Good rally. Nice rally.
For Eilert and the other players, Arizona is a second home. And in summers past, when they returned north, pickleball came with them. Zagzebski says when he started pickleball in Wausau, Wisconsin 7 years ago, he couldn't find another place that had it in the state. And now...
there is 90-some places to play in Wisconsin, so it's grown that fast back there, too.
Other players also have stories of taking the sport back home. And the man who brought it to Venture Out RV Resort years ago is a snowbird himself, from Washington, where the sport was invented. His name is Ewald Kunzel, and he's still playing here today.
And every year, somebody goes back to their state, home state, and somebody starts pickleball someplace else. And that's how I think pickleball really got going in this country.
According to the USA Pickleball Association, there are now almost 4,000 places to play the sport in the U.S. That's about a 300% increase from the numbers they listed 5 years ago. And that's just places registered with their website. Arizona, which is headquarters of the association, has 162 places. That's a lot of pickleballs. A lot of those places are private, though. You need to be a resident or member to access them. But public courts are popping up. Last month, the city of Scottsdale opened its first public courts in Cholla Park. And now, some Arizona players have their eyes set on bringing pickleball even further, overseas. Whether it takes hold in other countries is up to the residents there. The ball is in their court. It's the show. I'm Annika Klein.
Steve, you want to go play some pickleball this weekend?
Yeah, if it's in Scottsdale, you and I can meet there.
Absolutely. Well, if pickleball is not your thing, you can take a slow ride over to Harrah's Auction Casino to check out Foghat. They'll be performing tomorrow night at Harrah's Auction Casino.
You know who might enjoy pickleball? Super Puppies, Mark. The Adventures of Super Puppy tomorrow morning at 10 at the Great Arizona Puppet Theater in Phoenix.
Colin Jost of Saturday Night Live fame will be doing a stand-up tonight and tomorrow at the Tempe Improv.
And Sunday at 6:30 at the Wells Fargo Arena in Tempe, ASU's men's basketball hosts the Oregon Ducks.
The show is produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Annika Klein, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Regina Revazova, and Tiara Vian.
Sky Shout and Domenico Nicosia are our digital team. Our managing editor is Tracy Greer. The news director is Al Macias. Our executive producer is John, the perspicacious one, Hoban.
What does that even mean? Do I have to Google it?
Having a ready insight into an understanding of things.
Oh, that is him. We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Good story ideas, send it our way, the show at kjzz.org. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. This is member-supported KJZZ, FM, Phoenix, and HD. All Things Considered is up next. Have a great weekend. Thanks for listening. It's 3 o'clock.